Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Thursday, April 29th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who joins us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free at whyagain.org. If you go to that page, click on the red and white bullseye or the link in the upper left-hand corner of most pages that says Start Here. It will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've used to great advantage in my life for over 16 years to improve the quality of my emotional state, improve my relationships, and turn any negative emotional state into part of that infallible guidance system that we've each been gifted. You can also get the actual tool itself, simple PDF file, print it off, copy it, and use it as often as you'd like. You can go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. Before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you tap on that, it will give you access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. You can also download a host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through that worksheet process or asked clarifying questions about how the process works, or given powerful testimonials about how the active application of that tool in their lives has resulted in tremendous benefit. You can also go to your app store. I think I already mentioned that. You can also give us a call at 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, it'll put a little question mark by your phone number, and I'll announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. And we appreciate when people do that because it makes it easier for us to live into the intention we have with this work and this internet radio show. That intention is to be of service. We've also made the commitment this year to be working through the Course in Miracles lessons, and today would be the 119th day of the year. And the Course in Miracles workbook lesson, Lesson 119, is a review of Lessons 107 and 108. Lesson 107 reads, Truth will correct all errors in my mind. I am mistaken when I think I can be hurt in any way. I am the offspring of creation whose self rests safely in the mind of the Creator. Lesson 108 reads, To give and to receive are in truth one. I will forgive all things today that I may learn how to accept the truth in me and come to recognize my perfect safety, my sinlessness. Every hour on the hour, I will strive to remember, truth will correct all errors in my mind. And on the half hour, I will remember, to give and to receive are one thing in truth. Pam Grout's book, The Course in Miracles Experiment, titles Lesson 119 as, I invoke my superpower of love. She quotes Rob Bell as saying, God says yes, we can have what we want, because love wins. For morning and evening review, the two lessons. I am mistaken when I believe I can be hurt in any way. And I use my get out of jail free card to invoke the power of love. Pam writes, when my daughter, who was an avid Harry Potter fan, was in grade school, she and her friend Kylie ran around waving their pretend wands, casting spells and shouting phrases such as Ascendio and Obliviate. While I don't have a wand, I do believe in invoking the power of love. It works better than any potion or charm taught at Hogwarts. The Course, boiled down to its essence, says this, quote, I have one function, and it's the only thing that will ever make me happy, close quotes. Choose love, choose love, choose love. Anytime love's opposite, fear, or any of the other negative emotions, rears its illusory head, I reach for my wand of love, and I know that nothing can ever defeat it. That's the guarantee of the Course. Love always wins, because love is all there is, in truth. So that's our lesson for today. We have 52 minutes left. We have plenty of time for a conversation. We have spent most of the week giving monologues about various things. It's a Thursday, so there will be a MindShifter support group available tonight through Zoom for anybody who's interested. There is an alert out, one of the books that I have highly recommended on this and other shows is Glennon Doyle's book, Untamed. And you can now pre-order Glennon Doyle's book, Untamed, the Journal. Get Untamed, the Journal. Glennon talks about how it is full of the kinds of exercises that she did to try to unravel the conditioning she had to try and be what society taught her a young woman, a little girl should be, so that at about age 10 she began to move away from her bright, happy, fun-loving, creative self into the anxious, depressed person that it took her decades to get out of. So it's a one-of-a-kind journaling experience with exercises and images, and I just thought I'd mention that because it came across my came to my attention today, and that book itself has been I probably read it two or three times already, and it's probably going to be one of those that I go back to every year or two and reread. So we have a support group tonight. You can find information to join us on those support groups at mindshiftersacademy.org. There's a separate page for the Tuesday and Thursday login information. We've got 6 callers and nobody in the chat room, and we have plenty of time to talk about whatever strikes your fancy. Reality management worksheets, targeted journaling, taking 100% responsibility for one's emotional state, which is the only way to have any power to influence it. I was listening to the book The Tao Made Easy again this morning, and I was struck by how different that discussion about relationships and the Tao is from the kinds of things that Michael and I have talked about at various times over the years. And the section on relationship from the Tao Made Easy is much more in line with the teachings that come out of the Way of Mastery and Jayam and the Darshan deep dives with Jayam, the understanding that from various spiritual traditions, there are phrases like what begins in time ends in time. And there is a time for every purpose under heaven. And so things come and go, and relationships come and go, and they come into our lives. And sometimes it's a lifelong relationship, and sometimes it's a short-lived relationship. Sometimes it's a business relationship or a friendship. Sometimes it's a loving relationship where there are children who are born into the family and the relationship, and then it ends. And the talk in the Tao and going with the flow of life and understanding that change is inevitable in terms of the physical world and the energy of creation is about allowance, is about surrender, it's about looking for the benefit. And I had a 15-year-old in my office yesterday who was talking about love and relationships and sadness when somebody leaves the way you might hear an 80-year-old speak about it. But an 80-year-old who is conflicted and who's grasping, and the 15-year-old wanted to argue with me about how, you know, it's going to be devastating if this person leaves, and his relationship is somewhere less than a year old, and he's 15. And just the idea in our culture about how we are not whole and complete unless we have the person we want in our lives, the whole idea in our culture about grief and loss puts me in mind of a time a number of years ago. A woman called in, identified herself as being from Colorado somewhere, and she was talking about how she has this grief group, and they get together, and every once in a while she goes into these deep sobbing, crying releases, and they feel so good, and she feels so much better after it's over. And she was promoting the benefit of doing this deep, cathartic, grief-related crying. And I still remember Michael's response, and he was rather eloquent that day in talking about how we create the mindset, we create the language and the mindset and the energy for grief with our own thoughts, with our own judgments. Very much the way Michael Singer would talk about how we have this experience of the flow of life, and certain experiences we want to grab onto and others we want to push away. And then we create a belief system about how we should or how we're going to feel if anybody ever betrays us or if anybody ever leaves us, etc. And we pour a lot of energy into that. And then when it happens, we pour a lot of mind energy into creating the emotions that we experience. And Michael likened this woman's experience as having this mental structure of thoughts about the role of grief in her life, like being like a big 55-gallon drum barrel. And it's a structure of thoughts that creates that barrel. And it's a structure of thoughts about how bad it's going to be if somebody leaves and how much they love the person and however much they love them means they're going to have to feel that same intensity of pain and sadness if they ever leave or if they ever betray them, etc. And he described it as though here's this woman who has this container for her grief that's built out of her thoughts, that's expecting grief to come into her life when this happens or when that happens. And every once in a while, that grief container gets so full because, of course, life does progress and some of these things that we predict and we're afraid of and that we're convinced we can't handle, they eventually do happen. And then we generate our grief just as we have been telling ourselves for days, weeks, months, years, or decades that we're going to have grief if that ever happened. And then as we generate that grief and we put it in this container, in this place in us where we hold our grief or we hide away from our grief, eventually the container gets full. And then we do this cathartic crying, screaming, beating our chests, screaming into a hole in the ground, or you know, having a period of depression for X number of hours, days, weeks, etc. And it feels so good to get that barrel emptied. And Michael was trying to get this woman to understand that not only is the content of the barrel and all the grief something that she's creating with her mind energy and her thoughts, her conclusions, her beliefs, her expectations, but the actual container itself, the barrel, the expectation that she's going to go through this bad feeling and that bad feeling and that low energy time and that depression and that deep pain, that all of that, the structure of the barrel that contains all of that grief is also her own creation. And he talked about the use of the tools, the targeted journaling that he calls the mind shifter, the reality management worksheet, the breath work, as having the potential to dismantle the barrel so that if and when someone leaves my life because they've grown apart from me and they don't want to be with me anymore, or they die, or they get a job that has them move across the country and then they don't keep up the communication the way I had wanted, I do not automatically experience the sadness. I have a pre-programmed response pattern that leads me in that direction, and it's possible to question it. It's possible to spend far more of my mind energy celebrating all the good that I had, all the life lessons that I've had, all of the life lessons that the other person had, bringing up the memories of the good times, and letting those loving energies flow through me and celebrating the time that I did have in that relationship from a joyful filter over my mind, with a gratitude filter, an appreciation filter in my mind, not the grief filter, not the, oh boy, I'm going to be so sad, I'm going to miss this person every Christmas, every New Year, every, oh, I can't imagine walking in our favorite spaces without this person. Instead, I can choose to remember the wonderful exchange of energy and the enlivening, you know, feeding and fueling both of us that happened and how we've grown as people because we did have that time together. And if I focus my mind energy on it from the gratitude and appreciation and loving perspective, I create one sense of the experience in the moment. And if I bring out the filter of, you know, inadequacy and loss and grief, then I create those emotions. And the Tao Made Easy was talking about it more from the perspective of going with the flow and learning to appreciate what I have with someone when I have it with them, and appreciate the good times when they're good, and appreciate that if it turns sour or goes bad and I do my work and they are not willing to meet me, you know, in a new place or back where we used to be, then I can release it and I can let it be. I can go with the flow of life. And in some way, you know, it's a far more useful model to my mind than the, I have to get it back to the way it was. I want that person to go back to being how they were when we first met. I want them to stay with me forever, et cetera. I remember reading in, I think it was the book Awareness by Anthony DeMello, he talks about how people get this idea about love and commitment. And they say, you know, when I want you, you need to want me back. You need to want to be with me. And he said, well, what if I'm not happy? You want me to give up my happiness in order to be with you? And the person says, yes. And all these people in the seminar that he's in or the workshop he's in say, yes, absolutely. That's how love is. That's what commitment's about. And he says, okay, let me look at it this way. So you want me to stay with you even though I'm not happy. And I stay with you and you stay with me even though you're not happy. So neither one of us is happy, but at least we're together and that's love. So we have two miserable people that are staying together because they've got some ideal about how they should never leave. It's a fascinating premise that most people in our culture will not step back and examine and question. Most of us are living out that pattern of belief and conditioning that, you know, as Michael talks about to a great extent in other ways, is passed down generation to generation to generation, and it is not built on awareness of our true nature as love. It is not built on, you know, observation. It's built on shoulds. It's built on traumatic energy. It's built on cross-generational trauma energies that are passed down. And what we're hoping to do with this work is make it possible for every person who encounters this work to start questioning these things for themselves anew. And yeah, when I have a relationship with somebody that I really love and care about, and it ends, however it ends, they die, they move away, they say they've fallen out of love with me, they've fallen in love with somebody else, they say we've grown apart, whatever it is, there's an adjustment for me to make. And depending upon how much of my mental and emotional energy I have invested in that person and that relationship, it could be a major adjustment and all kinds of processing that I will need to do. It is not, however, the case that I am sad because they left. And one of the ways I like to talk to people about that so they can observe it for themselves is say, look, I'm only sad when somebody leaves if I really want them to stay. because a lot of people come into my life and they leave, and I'm glad they're gone. So the sadness or the gladness that I experience is a creation of the interpretation I place on that person and my interactions with them. So if I preload thoughts of this person lights up my life and fills me with joy and completes me, and it's so wonderful to be around them and their sense of humor and, you know, their taste and their smell and the sexuality and the spiritual connection we have and how we work so well together, and it's just wonderful, and I am happy because this person is in my life, then, of course, if they leave, regardless of the circumstances, I'm going to be thinking that the cause of my joy and happiness and fulfillment is now gone. And if I believe that, that will be my experience. And this is what I learned from a friend of mine, you know, decades before I met Dr. Michael Rice, and this is what went into the How to Say Goodbye to Good People Without Saying Goodbye to Good Memories workshop that's available absolutely free at mindshiftersacademy.org. On the website, I think it's under the educational materials page. There's there are two separate audio files. The first one's about an hour. The next one's close to an hour. I finally got a good recording of that workshop I gave where I talked about this process for going through termination or acknowledgement of the end of the relationship and reviewing the memories and distilling out the good, the bad, and the not so memorable, the life learnings, and those two audio files are available, and the PDF of the catalogs, categories that I suggest that we use to go through and actually do the work, to actually over time to sit down and review the relationship and answer a series of questions for myself about how my life was better for having known this person, how their life was better for having known me, life lessons that I know I learned from this, life lessons I think this person got from me. And this is whether it was a relationship I was deeply appreciative of or a relationship that was a struggle for me. This could be with a parent that we clashed a lot and I have mostly unpleasant thoughts about, or it could be from a parent that I felt was, you know, one of the main reasons that my life was as good as it is. Stepping into a process like that for me has helped me tremendously by doing a number of things. The primary things are when I willingly engage the process and allow myself to feel and express and describe, either in writing or verbally to myself or somebody else, the emotions. And I catalog the memories and I distill out, how is my life better? What life lessons did I learn from this relationship, good, bad, or otherwise? And if I engage that process actively over time, then the third thing that happens is I demonstrate to myself. I'm not lecturing myself. I'm not pretending. I demonstrate to myself that the pain and the sadness and the regret and all of those negative emotional states is not too much for me, that I live through it, that I can cry the tears and I can feel the rage and I can feel the deep sadness of the loss and I can feel the heart-aching connection of love and cherishing and appreciation, and I can let the tears come and I can feel those energies move through me, and it's not going to kill me, so I don't have to run away from them. And once that happens, then I no longer have to lock the memories and life lessons away in that part of my mind that we call, you know, the unconscious or subconscious. Because I will know, yes, when I let myself remember that, I'll have that stab of pain and sadness and grief, but it's just a momentary thing. And on the other side of it, attached to it, is all the memories of the good, the wonderful. The good, the holy, and the beautiful is the way a mastery would call us to recite it. So the idea about the impact of a relationship on me and my emotional state being observably tied to the interpretations that I place on it and the conditioning of my family and my culture. And to have it be actively there so that I can observe it and make change in it puts me in a position of liberty to do something about it, to have a sense of agency over my emotions in the moment and my learned benefit and accumulated benefit from the relationships that I engage in throughout my life. So I will take a breath here and take a sip of water and ask if anybody's got any comments or questions. Call in numbers 563-999-3581. Susan, welcome.
Hi, Dr. Tim. Great talk. I've had this question, and it's sort of embedded in what you're talking about. I'm aware that I keep telling the same story because we need to know what happened. We need information, and we need it in order to find ways to overcome the story and finally put the story away once and for all. We had a breathing session last night, the second to last session of this intensive. And Tim and I lay there on our mats, and Michael would comment here and there on people and how they were breathing. And afterward, several people spoke up and said how much they had gotten out of the breathing session. And I felt like that, and I've often felt this. I think it's in the musical Hair, where a young woman sings, "And I felt nothing, nothing." And I thought, oh, no, you know. I know we're not, Michael made it very clear, have no goals at all. Having done your mind shifter and having it fresh in your mind, including elements of the story, you will find your way to a new something, a new level of healing or new thoughts, new insights, whatever. Well, Tim and I dragged ourselves to bed afterwards, and I said, "How'd you do?" And he said, "I stink at this." And I said, "That's the way I feel." And, you know, that's the story. And we were going against what Michael, Tim and I have matching bags of garbage. We always think we're not going to do it right. We're going to be failures. This is very common. So we're commiserating. And he said, "Boy, our bags of garbage are matching. And I'm so glad yours matches mine. Because if you were soaring high with these wonderful revelations and insights and feeling great joy, I don't know what I'd do." So I thought, well, in a way, we are colluding in our favorite miserables. You know,
yeah,
we're
don't leave me. Right, misery
yeah,
loves
don't
company.
Leave
don't leave
crap.
Me.
Right. So I'm thinking about how this past week has been just one rolling stirring up of stuff. And I am not sure what to do with it even yet, but we both go to bed and think, oh, my God, we're really bad at this, and we really didn't get it, and maybe we don't belong in this group, and maybe these people are much more advanced, and all these questions, we're going to bed. In the middle of the night, I woke up at about 3, and this is where it gets into what you were doing with that song idea. I hope I can get through this without losing it again, but it seems as if we learn our lessons over and over and over, or I should say we know the truth and we teach it and we live it until we realize we need another level and we haven't really learned it at all. I think Michael's even saying that about this new set of early cassettes he found, and they were transferred to MP3s, and that's part of the offerings of this intensive, is we can listen to the early Michael with early Michael's voice telling us stuff in a very clear way that we're still learning and still being taught. So I think Michael probably does it too. Maybe we all do. We just go through cycles and cycles and cycles of learning some basic lesson that we need to learn. And, of course, we have to have the story in there. I guess my question is, or my confusion is, how do we know when we're using the story to maintain our victim's position? And how do we know when we're using it as part of the healing process? That's one question. I'll stop there and let you say something.
Well, what comes to me to say is I don't really use my story as a part of my own healing process. I give up my story as a part of my healing process. And after I've done that and moved on through healing, if I'm working with somebody else or experiencing somebody else who's doing work, and I share part of my story that I went through, that might be part of their healing. But if I'm still stuck and I'm telling my story, I'm not healing myself or anybody else by sharing that story.
Okay. Okay, that's, and so you have really worked.
Hey, stop it.
And to,
stop it.
What?
Stop it.
What?
Right now.
Okay.
Don't make me hang up on you, young lady.
All right.
Look at what you're doing in that. So you really have – no, I haven't. I'm no different than you. How many times have I come on this Internet show and said, okay, I got triggered over the weekend. I had to do these worksheets. I don't know what this is about, but I had this lump in my stomach and knot in my throat, and I felt sick, and I wasn't able to function, and I had a migraine all day, and I'm trying to do the show through a migraine because I was processing emotional work. Have you forgotten all of those?
No, but they might be different than the story that you worked through and got rid of. Yeah, I get it.
I just had to stop you because when you start a sentence with, you know, you really, I go, wait a minute, there is this idealized version of me coming out that is just pure garbage.
Mm-hmm, okay.
And I can't engage you in that fantasy play,
right,
that I am somehow better at this or above you or have mastered the tools. That's just nonsense.
Okay.
And it's part of what you do to, you know, distance yourself from the work or beat yourself up. You know, I have news for you. The fact that you and Tim are still attending these intensives, that is amazing. So when, just all by itself, because anybody who's been through one of Michael Rice's intensives knows this is not fun. This is not play. This is not a vacation. This is why he calls them intensives instead of retreats or vacation time.
Mm-hmm.
Now he jokingly and somehow tongue-in-cheek often says, come play. And he's working. Yeah, he might be at a different level as far as this goes. He might actually mean what he says when he says that he loves it when people are in the depths of their agony and crying. He might actually mean that, right? Mm-hmm. I don't mean anything like that. I say the opposite. I don't like that. I'm willing to do it with people, but I don't enjoy it. I don't think it's fun. So just notice what you're doing when you build the fantasy about how other people are getting all of these great transformations and insights from their breath sessions. These are people just like you. They eat the wrong thing, they get diarrhea, right? Their toenails grow as they get older. It's hard to clip them. These are people just like you.
Yeah. Well.
So crash in on that part of your mind that wants to elevate other people above you in one way or another on this spiritual journey, and just crash it. Imagine it's this glass cathedral and you can throw a big rock at it and it'll come tumbling down. But throw that rock every time you hear yourself elevating somebody up onto a pedestal or being so far ahead of you. And then understand that when you and Tim are talking about, you know, how you're no good at this, this is a wonderful catch. The way you presented it is a wonderful catch. This is our story. We're stuck in our story. And part of our story keeps us expecting a story that we have imagined to be better or different than what we're going through. And then every time we don't live up to that, we fall back into the pattern of negativity and beating up on ourselves. But the fact of the matter is, just because you keep listening to the internet shows or participating in the intensive or doing worksheets or doing journaling, or you're doing your work, and that's all that matters. You haven't given up. You know, there's this old thing that I collected several of these sayings and I ran them all together, and I said, you know, when you lose, don't lose the lesson. What does that mean? Mm. Well, every mistake, every misstep, every faux pas, every error carries with it a lesson. But you cannot learn the lesson if you don't own the mistake. If this only happened because of somebody else and this and that, and then it's not mine, and it's not mine. I didn't happen because of me, and so there's nothing for me to learn from it. So I need to own the mistake, right? I absolutely have to own the mistake, the misstep, the faux pas, whatever. And when I lose, I don't want to lose the lesson, which means I have to take full responsibility for my part in what happened and my reaction to it. Because I never truly lose until I quit.
Yeah.
Right? So as long as I keep going, as long as I come to the bat again, as long as I am willing to do another worksheet, or maybe I'm just fed up with the Michael Rice work, but I'm going to pick up Byron Katie's work or the Sedona Release Method, or I'm really going to dedicate myself to doing Ho'oponopono, or I'm going to go and find somebody who's going to work with you know, emotional transformation therapy, which uses light frequencies while I'm talking about things to help me get energetic shifts. I'm going to, as long as I don't quit, I don't lose. You never truly lose until you quit. So when you lose, don't lose the lesson. Step in, take full responsibility for it when you make an error or mistake, and then get back on the horse, as they say, right? Try another technique. And as long as you're doing that, and by every standard that I can imagine, you and your husband are doing that, so you're not losing. And you're not failing. It's not possible for you to fail. So as I said that last phrase, it's not possible for you to fail, it reminds me of this lesson in the Way of Mastery where it says, write these 9 statements on the top of 9 individual sheets of paper and then let yourself journal about them for a week at a time. It's not possible for you to be without love. It's not possible for you to be alone. It's not possible for you to taste death. It's not possible for you to taste genuine loss. You can create the illusion of loss and separation, but there is no genuine separation. It's not possible for you to suffer the dream of separation. It's not possible for you to be apart from your Creator. Here's the one for Susan and Tim Bingham. It is not possible for you to fail, period.
Thank you.
It's not possible for you to harm anyone or anything, and it's not possible for you to sin. But the one that speaks directly to Susan and Tim Bingham is, it is not possible for you to fail. So take a breath, give me a status check, tell me how you're feeling.
I'm feeling good, much better. It's been a hard morning. It's, as Michael Rice says, it's not Dr. Feelgood. I had a lot of anxiety, but a lot of insights. And I wrote a lot of journal early in the morning, and it's been very rich, but it's far from being sorted out. So what you say is, I mean, one reason I call this show isn't really even to learn something. It's to be walked beside for a while I mess around in my crap. Just have company in it for a couple of hours a day is so wonderful. And, you know, hearing other people talk, it's like there is no chit-chat on this show that I've, and that's one thing I really don't like. And I don't suppose any introvert really likes parties where people just can't really get into serious talking. This is so different. It's so good. Oh, and by the way, I know I'm, yeah, what?
By the way, you know what?
I did look up the Himba tribe.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was a tribe years ago who used to get together in the mornings and tell one another their dreams. That was found to be the creation of somebody who wanted to tell a beautiful story and make something up. The beautiful story exists. It's a lovely idea. It's the same with the Himba tribe. On the one hand, some research says some white guy went in there, an anthropologist or somebody else, and went in there and ended up making up a story that would just enthrall everybody. And I didn't even care when I read that. But then I did more, and I actually found a little video of a young mother and several members of her family and an infant, and they were singing the song. The song itself was so accessible to me in a way that made it seem as if it wasn't really true. I can't explain that, but it seemed very facile and lightweight and kind of universal. It didn't seem particular, but that didn't matter either, because I realized I know about that song. I even wrote, do you know the story of the emperor and the nightingale? It's a Chinese fairy tale.
Yes.
Well, if you remember it, the emperor is introduced to or hears about a nightingale whose song is the most beautiful thing in the world. And he tells people to go find the nightingale. They find her. They bring her to the palace. And they put her in a cage. And they make fun of her. And she can't sing. And then finally, the kitchen maid who gets it lets her go. At one point, lets her fly free, and the emperor falls into a terrible depression, and he declines and declines. And the people of the court send over to somewhere to make a mechanical bird that would be a mechanical imitation of the nightingale. And it's sent to the emperor. Well, the Nightingale is cranked up and she sings her song and does her silly little dance. But the emperor is dying and this bird means nothing to him. He misses the real Nightingale. And finally, word gets to the Nightingale that the emperor is failing and she returns. And she sings to him. And they sing an aria together. This is an opera. I set this story in an elementary school with the kids there, third and fourth graders, at one point. And the main singers were professionals with beautiful voices. And the emperor says how much he missed her. And she says, "You've got it wrong. I'm only reminding you of your own song. Take it for yourself. It's yours." You've been telling us that all along, Dr. Tim. But, you know, there's this love duet between them. It's pure love duet. And the emperor is healed and gets out of his bed, and the opera ends with him singing good morning to his courtiers and all the children. There were probably 100 children in this thing. And it's a great story, and it's perfect for an opera. But I knew that back then. That's what I'm saying about the sort of cyclical learning we're doing. I knew that back then, and yet I didn't learn it. I guess learning and knowing are kind of different things.
Well, you did learn it at a certain level, and now you're learning it at another level. So we have about 8 minutes left, and we have a whole series of hands that popped up. So I'm turning on Ellen, who was the first one. Ellen, welcome.
Hi, Dr. Tim. Hi, Susan. I just have something very brief to say. I just wanted to chime in with you and mention that Susan has so many times put me up on a pedestal. And, oh, how enlightened I am. And it's like, don't do that. I know you maybe you believe it, and I know you think that it must make me feel good, but it honestly doesn't, because it makes me feel like I can't be with you and that I'm somehow, different from you. And you know, I have, like, and we've already seen how many of the same issues we have, exactly the same. And I'm no more enlightened than you are, Susan. So I just wanted to chime in with that.
I will be very careful next time. Thank you.
Anything else, Ellen?
No, that was it.
Okay, thank you. I will mute you and turn on the microphone for 760. Who do we have? Well, apparently,
night
technology.
With Susan.
There we go.
Oh, okay, you got me now.
Yeah, is this Ann?
This is Ann. I was there the same time Susan was last night. And Susan, I've heard some of these same things that I used to think, and I'm still working on. And Dr. Tim, maybe you can speak to this, or at another time if there's more callers. Comparison. I was always comparing people or myself to others. And of course, then that's crummy because I'm never going to measure up to somebody else. It's kind of the pedestal thing as well. And, you know, and I'm learning not to. So as you're talking, Susan, right towards the end, you did benefit, right? Because you woke up at 3 a.m. and you started journaling. And I remember Michael saying, hey, things don't always come on the same night as we do the still point. Things happen later, can be a day, a week later. Jean was saying that too. So anyway, I just wanted to encourage you that you are doing it. And then I know the comparison thing is not a healthy thing. Right, Dr. Tim?
It's the source of most of our suffering, yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, that's it.
Anything else, Ann?
No, that's it. That's enough.
All right, blessings. Thank you for the call. Area code 828, you're in the air.
Hi, this is Magda.
Hello, Magda.
Hiya. I've been sitting here kind of laughing because I'm, Susan, you're bringing to mind my own stuff about comparing myself to others. And what I experienced last night was, and I'm going to tell you, I admire you so much for being willing to share this. Anyway, last night when we were doing the still point breathing, I was so aware of my ego being very much wanting to be recognized. I heard Michael mention to other people, oh, that was a great still point. Oh, you're doing so well. And, you know, number of people, he'd call them by name. And I thought, well, isn't he noticing me? Am I not doing a good job?
Yeah, I did the same. Michael, shut up. You know, you're telling David that he's got the perfect still point. I mean, how to take a nosedive?
Well, I actually really appreciated all of the input that he was giving people. I thought that was pretty active and wonderful. I just wanted him to give me some recognition. So that's why I'm laughing. It's just like, oh, I enjoyed my still point. And I was during the still point, I was actually laughing at my ego. Like, come on. So anyhow,
yeah.
I join with you, right. And I'm so grateful for your being brave enough to call in and
thanks, Magda.
You to be brave.
Yeah, it was like a circus last night. My neck hurt, and then I was lying on a hard floor. My bottom went to sleep. One hand went to sleep. You know, it was just my mouth was dry. I wanted to swallow, and then I think, Michael, see that swallow? I'm not supposed to swallow. I mean, it was just a charade. But somehow, in the middle of the night, I got the goods anyway. So
yep.
None of us have to worry at all about anything.
Absolutely right. Absolutely. Yeah, I saw you on the mat on the floor, and I thought, oh, my God, I couldn't do that. My back would not make it through that at all.
I'm not going to do it ever again, let me tell you. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I just wanted to congratulate you on being so very, very honest with yourself. And as Dr. Tim said, stop it. You know what I'm talking about.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Tim.
All right.
Thanks,
Magda.
Love you guys. Yeah.
So, area code 847, you're in the air. Is this Mary?
It's Mary. I'm laughing, too. And, Susan, you are so awesome. And once again, you're putting into words something I've experienced so many times. And I am not the breathing thing for me just, I don't want to say it hasn't worked. I mean, I went to the intensive, and I saw people, you know, just going through hell, really. And I'm thinking, like, yes, I could release all this stuff. It would be so wonderful. And I just beat myself up after saying, I can't do this. I'm, you know, why am I here? You know, all these people know so much more than me and you know, that whole thing. And then finally, one time, Michael and Jeannie were at Unity in Woodstock, and we did a breathing session. And it was the most happy thing. I've never heard anybody talk about this before, but it was this experience. The windows were open. The birds were singing. It was like beautiful. And I had the greatest time. And that's the only time I've actually had results from still point breathing. But I finally just had to let it go. But I was just like, I felt like I was missing out and not doing. And also what you're talking about, story, I so get that. That's, wow. This is a great talk, but yeah, you're so good at articulating sometimes what I'm thinking. It's amazing. But yeah,
someday we'll have to meet, I hope. Thank
I
you,
hope
Mary.
So. I certainly hope so, yes. That's really all I had. But yeah, I don't do still points so much. Once in a while I'll try it, but it just hasn't been my thing. So I'm moving on to other things. But that's how it is.
All right. Well, thank you for your input and for the call, Mary, and for all the other callers. And Susan, thank you so much. We're down to our last 25 seconds. So, again, thank you so much, Susan, for the call. It always helps here at the end of a show to have somebody interrupt the monologue, especially when you are being as honest as you are. It benefits us all. So thank you for that.
Welcome.
And I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. Well, with all the callers you had, I wished I had gotten on sooner, but I was tied up with Dad and the nurse and Aria, and so I'll have to go back and listen.
Well, there's one hand we haven't gotten to, which is 813. And
okay.
I was answering them in order, but then Mary got bumped off, and then she came back on. So that's you have that person labeled. I don't know if that's who that is. But anyway, I will let you have a
okay.
wonderful show, and I'll talk to you later.
All righty. Have a good one. Thanks. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Thursday, April the 29th, 2021. And their call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. Welcome, Michael.
Well, thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. Honored and delighted that you're here with us. We get to engage in this absolutely amazing conversation once again that informs us of the, when you go back to the first century Aramaic language, the deepest levels of healing that have ever been comprehended on the earth. It's just most amazing when you actually get back to the original conversation 2,000 years ago, what was being spoken of. And it brings, when you get to the first century Aramaic thought structure, it brings most of the teaching out of the arena of theology and religion into the arena of physics and physiology and psychology and genetics. And you realize that the teachings are there that are grounded in actual science for bringing this energy system. You can bring the oldest of the teachings from the Aramaic and then the newest of the understanding of physics. And you realize that your body is not a physical substance, a physical structure. That's just an icon in your mind. That's something created by your mind. But that your energy system is real and is governed not by the rules of some theological theory, but rather by the rules of physics that are eternal forces created by the Creator at creation. So it puts the whole conversation in a different context. And then you understand how the human mind works, how the interaction between mind and body work. And it's just, it's mind-boggling. So we're here and delighted that you're joining with us in boggling our minds and bringing forward deeper and deeper levels of understanding. And so we've been reading from the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? We are up to page 61 in the chapter on Aramaic wisdom, or pardon me, on ancient wisdom. So we're looking at this conversation. We're having this conversation with a character named Richard, who's a recalcitrant kind of guy who doesn't really want to hear anything we're talking about, especially if it's backs of what he considers to be religion. And step by step, we've been slowly introducing him to the fact that understanding how his own mind works and how his mind brings forward pain and prejudice from past experiences to his state today, and that he can change those things that compromise the perceptual quality of his mind's output, it just, you know, opens a whole different conversation. And, of course, the ancient wisdom that we're talking about is the Aramaic. So we're looking at forgiveness as a process of release, and speaking of that, in the Aramaic context, you know, we live in a culture that gives us a Greek idea that forgiveness is about how I let you off the hook for the pain that's moving in me, where 2,000 years ago you realized Yeshua was talking about how you address and remove the pain that's moving in you, rather than try to let somebody else off the hook for it and live in a world of blame. Which, of course, blame leads to conflict. Conflict leads to, you know, all the insanity that's going on the planet is a result of that dynamic. And so we're looking to reverse the false understandings and come into true possession of the knowledge that was there in the Aramaic. And we're talking about the fact that, you know, there's a process called healing, and when you put an energy into the human energy system, it produces symptoms. If you're in pain because of that energy, then you're going to have to remove the energy from your system, which means you're going to get to experience some symptoms. We'll detail that a little more later, but Richard now is asking the questions, well, how long is that going to take? And my answer is kind of a tongue-in-cheek, as long as it takes. It can be a pleasant, the healing process can be a pleasant, exciting, and easy experience, though. Unfortunately, many, because of resistance, don't go through it easily. It's an individual process that can be accelerated, I added. How? He says with some excitement. Well, there are many factors that determine how quickly you move through your healing, how easily you process. These include your nutrition, exercise, your support system, and a host of other factors. The best way I know how to apply what I like to call cosmic grease, is to apply what I like to call cosmic grease. And, of course, cosmic grease is the willingness to embrace with love whatever you find inside yourself. It speeds up the process immeasurably. If we have shuddered and held our breath and railed against the pain that's going on inside of us, that pain tends to solidify and we hide it from ourselves. The breath is one of the keys to how we hide pain from ourselves, and the opening of the breath is one of the ways that we access that which we've been hiding. And then add to that the willingness to embrace and move through whatever doesn't belong. You know, I can go back, I'm not sure exactly how many years, probably 25 or 30 years ago, and look at the previous 20 or so years of doing this work and wondering, you know, reaching, stretching to understand what is it that causes healing to occur? What's at the core? What's at the root of all healing? I'd seen cases where people didn't seem any different than the person beside them, but one person moved through some healing and the other one didn't. There's an interesting story in the scriptures about a woman who had what they called an issue of blood for 12 years. Pretty serious situation for a woman in the Jewish culture, where if your menstrual cycle is active, you are unclean and can't go in the kitchen and feed your children or your spouse. So 12 years of that issue of blood is pretty profound. And we hear that this woman has some sort of an inner knowing that if she can just get to a higher support system, she will be able to heal. And that was termed as if she could touch the hem of his garment. And then we're told that in a throng of people, I believe the word in the scriptures is throng, I'm not sure exactly how many that is, that healing does occur, and Yeshua notices the energy shift in his field. And they speak of it as he experienced it as virtue had left him, and not in the sense of a moral type of situation, but that he realized that someone was drawing on his energy and noticed an energy shift in himself. And there's an instant stoppage of this disease process. It's a serious physical ailment. You know, 12 years is a long time for something like that to go on. She's healed right then and there. Now, of course, the religionists, generally speaking, don't really have any interest in the principle behind what's happening or understanding what's going on. They just want to create a situation where their religious leader is the king of all the leaders and everybody else is a wimp. And in fact, you're going to hell and you're a Satanist if you believe in any other than that one. And they lay the healing at his feet. But if you listen to him, he doesn't take credit for it. He's working with a principle. Yes, he's a high vitality being. To touch the hem of his garment, she was able to tap into the love that he brought into the world. And I'll offer for me, you know, this period back 25 or so years ago, it became clear that whenever a major shift occurred in somebody's life, and I don't care whether it was a physical disease that disappeared, a mental, emotional disorder, financial even, the two things that occurred simultaneously that allowed that to happen were that, one, this person stood in a space of willingness and was able to access the disintegrative energy that they'd been hiding from themselves directly. People access those kinds of things all the time, but they don't access them directly. They usually access them when they're projecting those energies into their brain's image of someone else. So they have indirect access to the dis-ease energy. When I say, you made me mad. Boy, I really want to heal my mad, but you made me mad. Well, the only way they have access to that energy of quote-unquote mad is when it shows up in their brain's image of somebody else. That's indirect access to that energy. It doesn't heal when that happens. It's when there's direct access, and the Aramaic forgiveness process is what gives you direct access, because it collapses the projection of that energy into your brain's image of someone else and allows you to go directly to the root of that. And when that occurs and you touch the hem of his garment, and we're not talking about an individual here, we're talking about the active presence of love. When love is conscious, active, and present, and it meets that which has been in hiding, we have hidden from ourselves in the mind, then the meeting of those two means that there is a transmutation of the lower dis-ease energy and healing occurs. It's a really important principle to understand. And, of course, there's a good reason to strive to bring love present to your life, to your mind, to your emotions, to your circumstances. But if you run around with a long, sour face, blaming everybody and always sour and nasty with people, a zinger for everybody every time you turn around, there's not much love present. There's not going to be much healing present. But you notice that this situation with this woman with the issue of blood, Yeshua says, he turns to her, he says, no, you know, I don't know how many, as I say, there are in a throng, are there 2, 10, 100, 1,000, I don't know. In one case, there were 5,000 we're told about, but only one person. I'm sure many of the people in that throng wanted, needed healing. Made the difference, he said, your faith, which I would offer is your willingness to believe in a principle and open the deepest hidden parts of your own heart and your own mind to the presence of love. And he put her healing process in her hands, not that he worked a miracle, as many would want you to believe. He worked a miracle in that he taught principles. And when you understand the principles, he says, the things I do, you can do in greater. You get that in greater. It's not that he becomes the hero of the story because he fixes everybody. He becomes the hero of the story because he understands how to do it, and he shows you. And then, of course, you have to do it. As he said, the things I do, you can do, and greater. But you can't do it by standing around in the old mindset, in the old ways of the world. It takes the awakening process of moving into that space of love. So again, the best way I know to accelerate healing is to apply what I like to call cosmic grease. It is the willingness to embrace with love whatever you find inside yourself. It speeds up the process immeasurably. So it's that willingness, that openness to allow that information to be accessed and flow. And that's exactly what we're working to have people understand and apply in their lives, to enter into that practice of functioning as conscious, active, present love, and to continuously move through anything that is less than that love, to free oneself of all hostility, fear, rage, guilt, grief, all dis-ease conditions. Relative to this human energy system, there are basically two qualities of energy. There's that which builds the system up and that which tears the system down. There's integrative and disintegrative energy. Disintegrative energy is that which kills. It is hostility, fear, rage, guilt, grief, drama, and trauma. Bring it forward in the presence of love, and you get dissolution. Breathe and bring it forward in the presence of love. You get fast action. Things start to move in the most incredible and amazing ways. And so that's the next piece from Why Is This Happening to Me Again? I like this book. I think it's fun. I hope you do too. And by the way, if you don't have a copy, it's out of print, so we can't sell you one. But if you go to Amazon or eBay, you can usually find a copy or two or three or ten there. So pick yourself up a copy. And or you can go to our website and you can download it free in any one of, I'm not even sure how many now, seven or eight or nine different languages. So just go to the website, just picture the book, click on the book, and you find a list of the different languages available. And so delighted that you're here with us to have this conversation. And we're at about the quarter way mark through this show. So, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody out there in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
Well, there are three hands that have been up since Dr. Tim, but I looked away for a half a second and I thought I saw it flash. So I'm not sure that one of them may have pressed one again. So I'm going to start with Magda and we'll see. Did you press one again?
Who are you talking about?
Hey, Miss Magdalena.
Oh, no, I'm complete. I'm just listening.
Okay.
Oh.
All right.
Awesome.
I'll
we'll
check
have a
the others.
All right. Okay. Anything to share from your breathing last night?
Well, I actually did share something with Susan and Dr. Tim. I'm a little embarrassed about this, which is my work to do. You know how you were. I had a good time all in all, especially with having that vision of myself as a four-year-old walking into the thick woods with this great big protective wolf next to me. That was fabulous.
Right.
But here's my embarrassment. I heard you calling people different names and making comments on how well they were doing with their breathing or their skill points or whatever. And I wanted some of that, and I thought, my ego was just rampant. Why is he not noticing me? Am I not doing well? It was really pretty amazing how that rose to the surface, and I noticed what it was. I realized what it was, and I just kind of laughed and chided myself about, oh, come on, ego, lay down, you know. So that was
that's funny.
Interesting. Yeah, very much.
Well, maybe you need to go back and listen again because I did speak to you a couple of times through the process.
Did you?
Do you not recall that? Yeah, I did.
I will need to listen. So
yeah, you'll have to give it a listen.
Yeah, that might say something about deflection and denial and all of that.
Selective hearing,
okay, yeah.
Perhaps. I don't know. We'll see. Give it a listen. So let me know what you think.
I will. Is it online now? Jeannie? Oh.
Yeah, I think she sent up the links to it.
Okay.
So, yeah,
okay.
The video's there.
Yeah, it's already out in the Facebook group. I put it out last night.
Facebook. Super.
There's been
Thank
quite a few
so
comments, yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay.
That was a sweet energy from the whole group.
Oh, very much so. Yes. It's a good time.
Yeah,
okay.
Definitely.
I'm looking forward to whoever.
Okay. All right, blessings. Bye-bye.
All right, I'm going to check and see then. Miss Susan, did you press one again?
I did not. I'm always happy to talk, but why don't you check with the other people? Because this is no fair. I already got a lot of airtime with Dr. Tim.
that old fairness issue of I don't deserve the attention. That sounds like a good worksheet topic for me.
Truly, though, some people have had their hands up for a long time. I think that's fair. I'll hang out.
Okay. Well, we'll go check with that other hand that's up.
All right. And we did have a new hand come up, too, but let me check the third one. Ann, did you press one again?
No. However, I was going to call in, but I just happened to already be on with Dr. Tim because I chimed in with Mary and Ellen and we were talking with Susan. But I had texted I would come on this afternoon because the details of my sleep issue is the fact of I need to eat earlier so that I can get to bed earlier. So somehow I have fallen back into the habit, and also I broke my abstinence from television. So last night was night 4 of zero TV. I thought that I could handle doing DVDs and do the Prime and everything, but then I would still wind up eating late. Oh, well, because I'm eating, I can watch it. Well, then I would stay and I have to finish. I couldn't, stop the story. I had to. So I just, without effort this time, I just stopped doing it because I had arranged some furniture different too, hoping that would help me. And I also looked at my question that's on the television, which is, what is my relationship with you that I'd done a while back? I changed that. I was answering it wrong. I was answering it like, oh, it's okay. I can do a few. But no, I can't because I was still using the television to numb the pain of whatever I was going through. So it qualified as an addiction. I need to stop it. And you told me that before a long time ago, just really quickly. Stop it. Well, yeah. But for some of us, it's a little more difficult to do. So I don't know. The wake-up sheets I need to do, is it because I want to stop? I mean, do I need to cancel the goal that I want to eat earlier? I want to go to bed earlier? Those would be two separate ones.
Yeah, I would suggest that you dig out the mind goal management sheet. And if you're not using that currently on a consistent basis, then start using the mind goal management sheet so that you're, what you're really talking about here is using or strengthening your faculty of will. And I don't remember from your personal code evaluation exactly where your will score was, but you're talking about strengthening that faculty. And so say it again.
It's up there. They use the will. It just switched places without, and I am getting better with that. However, yeah, but it's.
Well, okay. Then you've done laws of living. So you've got the mind goal management sheet.
Right.
I'd start digging that out. And it's what you're being called to do is to strengthen that faculty of will, spiritual faculty. And of course, you go back to the video on the personal code evaluation and watch that particular section on what are the assignments for strengthening will. And I go to it along with the forgiveness process.
And actually I did that earlier, but then I let it go. So I have a mind goal management sheet out here and it's like, okay, I got better at least writing them down. Like for today, I made a list on my planner. And I used that instead, but I was, again, sporadic. It was not consistent. So it goes back to, and I think there's a mind shift, I think, on one of those personal code evaluation that talks about mind management, consistency, something about consistency and managing.
Right. And remember that of the five things that will can do, one of them is it can maintain a goal. And it sounds like that's the one that you want to really strengthen, mm-hmm. is your ability. You know, you can pull it up. You've got the goal and you do it, it sounds like, for a day or two or three, and then you let it go. You're not maintaining it. So, you know, paying attention to that particular arena and strengthening it would be what you want to do.
And I think that came up last night with my stuff. It's about me. And what I do is I allow others to frame my goals. And so, oh, okay, I should go do that instead of writing it down. And if I write it down and I stick with it, it works. I know that it works because it's worked before. So staying out of letting others run my schedule.
So then the other thing that you might want to do is look at number 10 on the personal code evaluation. Again, I don't have it in front of me, so I don't know what your scores were like there, but that sounds like it's also that consistency or validity score. And so you might want to look at the assignments there, you know, watch those DVDs, do that mind shift, or do that word link, and tie all of that together to strengthen that consistency or validity score as well. Because it's when score is weak that we can be drawn off in other directions.
Mm-hmm.
So even if that was not showing up as one of your higher score or your lower scores, I do that one in conjunction with the will.
With the, yeah, absolutely. I agree. The other thing I wanted to ask about is my bone density scores went up still more. I've only been taking supplements
awesome.
For this last year. And then but they got worse, whichever, up or down. I don't know. It's still confusing, the minus this and the minus that. But I went and got the real report, so the one that my doctor printed out, which was just, you know, the figures, and where it had the pictures and it had the comparisons over the last years they've done it. Well, there was a period of 9 years where I didn't get a bone density. And I started looking at the comparisons. So why between 2010, 2009, 2011, you know, it's gotten worse. So rather than just do supplements, isn't there research behind the weight-bearing exercises? And I started that, and I fell off the wagon with that last week, but I'm starting back on today. I have the equipment here in the house now, the proper stuff, and that goes back to the will, doesn't it?
Following through, yes. Yes, being able to maintain the goal. Once you frame it, once you set it, being able to maintain it so that you carry through with it. And so I would, again, use the Mind Goal Management Sheet there. And, you know, one of the other things that I would, and if you'd like, you know, we can have a conversation off air if you'd like to check it out. But the Avacyn that we've talked about, you know, at least three people that I know of, their hair is getting darker. Magda was the first one that shared that with me. She'd been on the machine for about, I'm not sure now, maybe 5 or 6 months, in which she was noting that her hair was getting darker. And then back a couple of months ago, after I'd been on it for probably 8 months, I went down to breakfast one morning and Jean said, "Your hair's getting darker. What's going on here?" And then she started to notice with COVID, you know, normally she would get hers dyed on a fairly regular basis. And with COVID happening, stopped. And now, instead of coming in as a gray, it's darkening. So one of the things that the Avacyn does is it opens microcirculation and tends to drive nutrition deeper into the cell. And so that might be something you might want to look at as a support system for getting that nutrition in deeper into the tissue structure.
Okay, right. And I know that Julie has purchased that as well, and I can talk with her. But so what is the research, or what has been your experience with the weight-bearing exercises that, you know, help to build the bone density as well?
Well, basically, you know, it's the old adage, if you don't use it, you lose it. And, you know, if somebody cancels up, breaks a leg, and they're laid up for 3 months, they're going to have to do something to get the muscle tone back. They're going to have to use it and work it. Well, the bone is no different. The thing that causes a bone to be strong is that it gets to be used, and it calls for building strength. And if you don't do that, then there's no reason for it to maintain the density that it's designed for the load-bearing process that it does. And especially if you're eating acidic foods, and I don't know where you're at in that regard, but if you take, you know, the blood has to be a certain pH, I'm remembering offhand what it is, 5.3, whatever it is, like within a point or two. And if you eat a lot of acidic acid-based foods, drink acid-based fluids, and that would be things like coffee, sodas, those sorts of things. Phosphoric acid is in just about every soda. If you take in a lot of acid foods, it goes into the body, and the body says, oh, my God, we've got acid here. We can't let this get into the blood, because if the acid-alkaline balance of the blood goes off just by a point or so, there are only hours of life left for that body. It's going to die. And so when we do a lot of acidic thinking or foods or fluids, then what happens is the body says, I have to buffer this acid. Well, there's one mineral that's abundant in the human body, the most abundant mineral in the human form, and that's calcium. And most of it is in the bones, although there's a certain level of it in the blood as well. But if you do a lot of acid-forming foods and thinking, drinks, then the body pulls calcium out of the bone to buffer the acid so that it can dump the nutrition into the bloodstream without doing damage. So it kind of, you know, it prioritizes things. Yeah, we need that calcium in the bone, but we don't need it nearly as much as if this blood calcium or this acid-alkaline balance goes off in the blood, we're dead. So it tends to suck that out of the bones. And so when you get rid of those acid-forming foods, acid-forming thoughts, and acid-forming fluids, then the body has a better possibility of balancing itself. And instead of pulling calcium out of the bone to balance the blood pH, the calcium can stay in the bone. If people eat a lot of meat, a lot of protein, you know, the protein is acid, amino acids. If people do a lot of dairy, you know, the countries in the world that have the highest levels of dairy use and meat use are the ones with the highest levels of osteoporosis. Because when you take something that's that concentrated, you know, let's say a piece of cheese, in order to create a pound of cheese takes about 5 pounds of milk. That's pretty concentrated protein. And with that level of protein, the body, they promote it as, you know, build bodies with calcium from cow's milk. But the truth is the protein overrides the calcium, and the calcium isn't the right kind of calcium to go into the bone. So that's another thing to understand and get the right kinds of calcium. It's kind of like if I, an example I use is I'm building, I'm getting ready to go away for a couple of months, and I'm using 6-inch blocks to build my building, and I'm about a third of the way there. And you contact me and say, Michael, I just got a really good deal. I know somebody that wants to get rid of a bunch of blocks, and I know you haven't got all the blocks you need for your house yet. Do you want them? And I say, oh, yeah, sure, that'd be great. If you'd go ahead and buy them for me, I'll refund the money to you when I get back and just have them deliver them to the house. And you say, okay, great. And I get back home, and you deliver 12-inch blocks to my house. Well, I'm building my house out of 6-inch blocks. You can't use 12-inch blocks when you're building a 6-inch, using 6-inch blocks to build the house. So now what do I have? I have this waste product, all of these blocks in my house, and I got to get rid of them. And the body's trying to throw off excess calcium if it's not the right kind of calcium that gets into the bone. And there are only a couple different, I don't remember exactly the numbers, but there's something like, if I remember correctly, 32 different isotopes of calcium, and there are only two or three of them that can go into human bone. Cow's milk isn't one of them. So, you know, there are a lot of factors that come into what goes on with calcium absorption and bone density. And certainly exercise is one.
So, yeah, I can see, though, that I have not been in the gym. I have not done weight-bearing exercises except for walking with my backpack on, which is not enough, that over the last 2 years. So even, you know, because I had one a year, when you have higher numbers or like that that are moving towards Medicare will pay for another one, you know, once a year. And so I was able to get it like in a year. But the one before that, so I was not moving enough. So that's part of it. And then what about the goat cheese? Would it still be the same? Goat cheese?
No,
I mean,
goat milk is a whole different product. It's totally different from the structure of cow's milk. You know, you think about a cow, you've got a 50-pound body that is born, and within a year, it's up over 1,000 pounds. If you want to build one of those bodies, man, that cow's milk is awesome. But goats aren't quite like that, and actually, goat's milk is much closer to mother's milk. So if you're going to use a cheese, I think goat cheese and goat milk is much healthier than
Right. I have been watching, you know, what I've been eating is just not enough. Okay. All right. I have a plan. I mean, I had a plan before, but now I need to do the work to be consistent with it and keep it on myself, which is what I got from Stillpoint. You know, and that's what was hard to take. I've known it, but I need to take action on it to keep it on myself and not others, you know. Okay. Okay, I'm breathing. Thank you.
All right. Awesome.
All right. Blessings. Thanks.
Hey, lots of love and blessings. All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Okay. And we have another caller, area code 314. I believe this is Mr. Doug.
Hello there, Michael Gainey. Yes, it is.
Hey, sir. Welcome.
I just really
on your mind today.
I really enjoyed your introduction today and kind of wanted to comment on that and maybe take it a little further. When you were talking about how about Christ and miracles and so on, I've had this question on my mind trying to sort out the whole Christ died for my sin thing and also how it feels like sometimes that because of their misunderstanding of forgiveness, you're a little hard on the traditional Christians, and yet I see that they get benefit. And it sort of opened the gate for me. It's like, okay, so what happened in that community, at least for, I mean, I see the distortions, but Christ, and I just wanted to get your, you know, feedback on this too, is that Christ, somehow the whole idea that he sacrificed opens the door to love for a lot of Christians. It just opens the door to, like, they think, oh my goodness, he sacrificed for me, so... So then they feel like I can let that love in, and that starts their healing. Even if they don't understand and they have this church-driven misunderstanding that they have, that God hates them or, you know, that somehow they have to be redeemed from their evil ways through this sacrifice of this innocent being, it still opens the door. So for me, that sort of helps bridge, and I just, you know, when you were saying how he, again, it's, just keep going here, I can stop any time, but like in my, the way I was brought up, the whole Garden of Gethsemane thing Christ did was his suffering taking on our sins, and as you've reframed it, it's like he was purging out of himself his own unhealed yet content so that he was willing and ready as a clear and open being to go to the cross. That's my understanding. And to do whatever the Father wanted. And so I'm just, you know, having a discussion about saying that the opening of the love was the most powerful part, that he's saying to that woman, you know, your faith healed you. And what opened that gate was him, his presence just opened the gate for her to let that love in to be healed. Am I understanding that more or less as you're sharing it today?
Well, my take would be that, you know, it doesn't really explain to us what preparatory work she had done. She comes into the space ready for something, and he is the space and supports her. So he doesn't take credit for it or even initiate, although maybe it was contact with him that initiated for her. I don't know. It doesn't give us any explanation in that regard, just that she was prepared and ready for that kind of support, for that level of support. And I would tie that to, you know, being in the uptight, locked down, physiological, you know, sympathetic nervous state, where the unwillingness is, where the resistance is, where the holding on is, and moving into the parasympathetic state where the body starts to open, capillaries start to open, blood flow happens, nutrition and oxygen are delivered to the cell in abundance, and all of that is going to open the healing process and then add that key ingredient of conscious, active, present love, which I would interpret that as what she gained from touching the hem of his garment. She touched into a level of support that she couldn't achieve on her own. And so as far as the suffering being a gateway, that's certainly one way to look at it. That would be, to me, that just thinking about the best way to express it, I would see it as much more profound, and if it's not available, then let's take the lesser route, but I would see it as much more profound for somebody to recognize that the same basic nature that was in Christ is in them, and that that mind, you know, Paul talks about, it's the mind of Christ in me, that we each have that mind, and that is the mind of love, which I would interpret quite literally as created out of the mind of and the actual presence of the love of God. And so to me, taking someone directly to that knowledge and opening, and, you know, you've heard me do it hundreds of times probably, where I ask people to tap into the essence of the newborn, and that newborn energy is purely the presence of love. And that is where the ultimate healing is going to occur. Can I vicariously connect to someone else's love and move into it? Yes. But my take would be to put somebody through a whole course on suffering to get to that is a tough way to get there. And I don't think that the Gethsemane experience was necessarily preparation for the cross. I think the Gethsemane experience was a presentation, or pardon me, the preparation for demonstrating what love does when under stress. You know, he walks out of the garden, you know, he had asked disciples to be there as support. He was looking for their active presence of love to support him in his process in Gethsemane. And at one point he says, you know, can't you guys stay awake for an hour? Can't you stay in the presence, holding the space for me for even an hour? And I also take that. This was an instruction I got a couple of weeks ago in a Stillpoint session that I was doing, was that that's also his invitation to you and I today to stand at the garden, at the gate, and be that presence of love to support opening the processing of this enormous quantity of pain that exists on the planet, this enormous quantity of trauma. But to me, the most important part of that whole process, once he stepped out of the garden, was when he confronts the enemy. And this is in terms of a very practical and real lesson for us. He steps out of the garden. His henchman is there, the guy who's, you know, asked about a sword and, you know, ready to kill anybody that gets in his way. And it's interesting, the guy who's got the sword and is going to kill, who's going to, you know, save him, he refers to that man directly as Satan. And he says, "Get thee behind me, Satan." And then he describes what he means by that. He says, "For you think in the mind of man rather than the plan of God." And then he turns to the man who he knows is going to have him mercilessly slaughtered, and he does the human thing, like an actual human being, love. He reaches forward instead of dressing the man down and making sure his wounds are, you know, pointed out and made more terrible, as the non-being mind would do. He turns to this one who's going to wound him tremendously, and he offers him healing. He offers him support. He demonstrates what it is to function as a human being. And to me, that's one of the most important lessons when we've got the brain cells for it to get from that whole experience. And then, you know, and you've also heard me say it kind of in a tongue-in-cheek way of, so people watch him functioning as a human being with a high priest servant, and they say, "Yeah, and did you notice that doing that got him dead?" And here's what he was really being prepared for. And that is, yes, I noticed they got him dead, but did you notice they couldn't keep him that way? That
right, because
he was not locked into the traumas in his body because he had worked through them. Therefore, he could not be drawn into death by that torture and the actual murder of his body. And, you know, took him 3 days to rebuild it, and, hey, I'm back. So it's I see it as a demo. The real savior part of that is when we can see it as a demonstration for ourselves rather than, well, it happened 2,000 years ago and it's going to take care of us today. You know, I watch a lot of people who hold that belief system, and I see them in jails, and I see their children committing suicides, and I see their failures and their spousal abuses and the trauma that they're going through, and I say, you need something else. You need some very real tools that will work in your life today for freeing yourself of those things that inhibit you from following the example of, if the enemy shows up, I reach out in love and offer healing rather than more of the abuse that I've been had inflicted on me. Is that fitting with your search?
Yes, it's helping. And it's the goal being to be operating as the presence of love at that level that he was demonstrating, and that he's demonstrating this example of what's possible for us. And then I also feel that for some people, as I think I heard you more or less acknowledge, that perhaps, you know, a beginning stage for some people, and that's how I'm seeing it, is that perhaps for some people who are so steeped in all of these false beliefs about how they're no good and they're worse than, you know, the dirt of the earth, it's like, okay, well, somebody sacrificed for me, so at least I can open the gate to the possibility that somebody could love me, or that I could be worthy of love in some way, which is like just opening the crack, you know, to let love in and start the healing. And then the other idea I got out of all that was that perhaps not so much in preparation for the cross, but in preparation to remove everything less than love that needed to be removed in the Garden of Gethsemane to be completely ready to demonstrate the resurrection, perhaps. But I also heard you saying that he was inviting us all there to hold love for all the challenges of the earth, you know, for all of the sin and difficulties and off the markedness and pain in the earth, that he was holding presence for that to help redeem or open the space for that to be healed, and inviting us to do the same. Is that what I've heard you say reasonably?
Yeah, that's where I go with it.
Okay, so
and that's demonstration. The demonstration that when someone comprehends, oh, I'm capable of that, that's when that big shift occurs, rather than I'm disabled and somebody else has to do it for me.
Right. That as he was, is who we ought to seek to be. And as he said, do
yes.
As he did and more, right? Instead, he saved us all and we don't need to do anything else. And he's different from us, and that's one of the great distortions that exists, is that he's somehow the only begotten Son of God, and we're inferior forever.
Yeah, and in the Aramaic, the words that have been translated as only begotten translate properly as first begotten.
That's important. First begotten.
That's important.
Well,
yeah, we were invited into the club.
And how would you interpret that? As in first brought forward from the heart of God, like an older brother?
I think an older brother would be a right way to say it. And, you know, coming up in a world, if you look back 2,000 years ago, the levels of hostility and fear, the rage, the abuse, the disproportionate punishment that existed in the culture was pretty horrendous 2,000 years ago. So he came into that. His genes were of that. And recognizing that that's what needed to be overcome, he went to work. And I would hear that particular phrase as, so here's someone who reached a critical mass of healing his genes, his genetic history, his physiology. You know, I see the time spent in the Garden of Gethsemane. You know, he starts out and he says, you know, if this cross, I don't know if I can do this. I'm really not too interested in this. And he's obviously listening. So he's got direct communication with that mind that is in him that even Albert Einstein, you know, acknowledges exists. If you're a real scientist, you got to know that there is a spirit working throughout and in this world, is what Einstein says. So obviously he's got a clear communication with that power that resides within. And so I would see the first begotten as, in the context of where the average person lived, moved, and had their being, which was in rage and vengeance and, you know, I mean, just some horrendous injustice, was the first one to awaken fully to functioning in that context, going back to the space where he functioned out of the original mind that we were each given, and that is the mind of love. And so that's how I would understand the first begotten. And, you know, he says, at one point, I've opened the door wide. Nobody can close it. You want to come through? Come on. I'm inviting you. Here's the demonstration. Here's how you do it. And sadly, a lot of that has been misinterpreted. And it's almost like an unconscious effort, or maybe a conscious effort, of those who've not opened the door, who've not done the work, who have not walked through the door, to say, oh, I know what it's all about. Let me tell you what our dogma and our doctrine is, rather than, here's how you walk through the door that he opened. We each have to do the work of walking through the door, which means facing that in us, which is not founded in love, and the willingness to process through and forgive all of that.
So as in this case, holding it from that space that you're speaking of, it's like he was begotten in his lifetime. It's like he demonstrated the bringing of the ability to bring the genetics, all of the disharmony, everything that was going on, the hatred and so on, that was given through the genetic aspect into the full transformed action and activity and consciousness of love, so that then he was free from all of that and demonstrated how all of us can do that, right?
Yeah, that would be it. And in the context of people, I mean, there's one story I can remember how shocked I was reading it. And there's a young woman who's the son or the daughter of a tribal leader. And, you know, this is a tribal society, and there's one of the other tribes that the son and the two meet, and they fall in love, and they end up having sex. And, you know, that's like, you know, the penalty is horrendous. And the young man submits to the father of the woman he wants to marry. And he says, I really, you know, want to marry your daughter. And yes, we've made a mistake, and I'm willing to do anything that needs to be done. And my father standing beside me as our tribal leader, our tribal chief, will do whatever you ask. And so the father of the girl says, well, you know, we are Jews and you're going to have to convert. And so the whole tribe agrees, okay, we'll convert. Well, what's the first thing you do with men when they move into Judaism? You chop off the tip of their sexual organ. And so that's what they did. And, of course, you're not much of a fighter in that condition. And the father of the girl went in and slaughtered everybody in the tribe. I mean, proportionate insanity. But that's the kind of thing that was going on. And so to wake up from that and to find fairness and to find functioning as the presence of love and to develop the tools for doing that and be willing to hand them to the world, that to me would be the first begotten, the first one who woke up and said, oh, my God, what are we doing here? This is crazy. We're designed to function as love. What are we doing? And then standing strong in that and having developed a whole body of work to bring forward to the world and offer it to people and energetically open that door for everyone to make the move through it if they're willing.
Exactly.
And then recognizing that there's work to be done as opposed to, oh, it's some kind of magic formula. You say magic words and then you see it's all done. And I mean, I've heard people in the church today say, well, yeah, well, if you make that declaration, then it's all taken care of, and even if you go out and you become a killer or a thief or whatever, you're still, quote-unquote, saved. It's like, you know, whew, talk about misunderstanding how an energy system works. That's about the epitome of it. But it does, you know, give room for a dogma that if people buy it, they're like, well, this is pretty easy, you know. Those disciples that left when they said to Yeshua, how do we please God? And Yeshua told them, and they said, too hard a saying, and they left and never came back. It's like, well, they made an easy path. All you have to do is declare these beliefs and say these magic words, and you see, then it's all done. And that's not anything like what Yeshua said. Yeshua said, there's work to be done. You know, you've got to clean up your act. And not just declare a belief in me, but, you know, you never find him saying that. In fact, the place where he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, in Aramaic, that's an idiom. And what he's saying is, here, I've shown you the path. You know, a man and his work were one, similar to, you know, I and the Father are one. You know, if I were using an Aramaic idiom, and let's say you were supposed to meet with me tomorrow, and I couldn't make it, and I sent my son, Michael J., you would turn to somebody and say, you met with Michael yesterday, because I and my son are one. Well, a man and his teaching were one. So he's not in an ego sense saying, I am the way, you know, it's me, I'm the hero here. He's saying, I've got a body of work I've given you, I've offered you, and here's how you do it. Now go and do it. Eat my body and drink my blood is an Aramaic idiom that says you've got to incorporate, understand, and integrate everything that I know if you want to actually follow me. And so he gives the pathway. And in that sense, yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen anywhere else on the planet that pathway exists. So is he Savior? Absolutely, 2,000%. And to me, in a whole lot more realistic way than a magic incantation, which is what the pagans were about doing, you know, repeating magic words and thinking they'll get a result from it. And we're down to the last minute. So, Doug, we could pick this conversation up tomorrow if there's more to be done. Otherwise, I'm going to just invite everybody to have the best year yet of your eternal life. Thank you for the thoughts, Doug. Good discussion. Opens some good spaces. And blessings. We'll see you tomorrow. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mindshifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.